Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
What's up, everyone? Derek Evers, Chris Robbins, here with a... This is our most pressing, not pressing, entertaining episode of Nothing Urgent, I think,
ever,
yet.
Of all time.
I think it is. It's a big one, and we're upping the ante this week. We have Andy Greenberg, who is the author of This Machine Kills Secrets, which I didn't even realize he was the author of until I contacted him, which makes this even better. But he's also a Forbes staff reporter who recently did a piece about, well, I should say the full piece that he did was a piece on the Dread Pirate Roberts, who is, am I saying that correctly? Andy's here right now.
Yeah.
Who is the man behind a black market drug website. But how I actually found the article was via the sidebar, which is you bought weed over the internet.
Yeah, I bought weed, but... You know, you can do much more than that on this website that's run by the Dread Pirate Roberts. The website is called The Silk Road, and some of your listeners might have heard of it already. Basically, you can buy any drug imaginable. Like, weed is just the beginning. You can buy heroin and crack and cocaine and any kind of synthetic, psychedelic you can imagine. It's just anything.
That is amazing.
Who would use such a service?
I know.
Not me.
Of course. I mean, this is really just a public service announcement that this exists, and it's a threat to our children.
And then we will be joined in about 15 minutes or so by Sid Butler of La Savie Fave and French Kiss Records, who are playing a show tomorrow at the House of Vans. We asked to have them here in the studio as well, but they got busy working, because Sid also runs French Kiss Records. So we're going to be calling him at the office. We'll chime in with him in a little bit. So this episode is taking a little bit of a... We're reconfiguring it as we go.
The French Kiss office is just like two giant buildings French kissing.
No, they actually have a really... I don't want to give away any secrets, but they have a very nice office. I've been there.
Well,
right. And a very, very nice locale. So before we start with Andy, Chris, how was your week?
This has been a pretty busy week. August is going out with a bang.
It is.
De Blasio's up by 14 points in the mayoral.
And they're hammering. Everyone is attacking him like crazy. Even Bloomberg's weighing in now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's going to feel compelled to here in a few weeks if de Blasio, you know, wins. I mean, if there's a runoff and it's de Blasio and Quinn or whoever, he's probably going to throw his weight against whoever isn't de Blasio. But this poll shows that he's, like, pretty close to the percentage where he wouldn't even need a
runoff.
That's
interesting.
Which is what really is making Bloomberg shit his pants. That's happening, and then... this book is coming out by two AP reporters that basically details that the NYPD is conducting wholesale surveillance of Muslim communities, specifically mosques, which is the only time that's ever happened in American history, recent American history. Like, the FBI won't even touch that. So that's sort of big news. I'll be interviewing those guys tomorrow, and my interview will be going up on Gothamist soon afterwards. So it's a busy week in terms of things.
That is.
Important things.
Man, now I feel I just interviewed No Age. That's not as
that
exciting.
Was good. Derek had a really good interview, but it was like explain. It was more of like, it wasn't just an interview. It was more of like a critique on.
Well, it was more of, I see they kind of represent a now older generation, even
Derek
though they're still very relevant.
68 years old.
Yes, and this past generation was very intertwined with the DIY movement that came to personify what Brooklyn was, and you know now is being pilfered for corporate reasons. And so it was kind of about that, like, where do they feel they fit in, whereas, like, you know, they're on Sub Pop and they're playing FYF Fest and big festivals, but it's kind of like the antithesis of where they came from or what their you know, mantra or
and
whatever.
How apt being that this week was the week of the VMAs, which I didn't watch, but apparently a lot of America
something
did.
Happened with Miley Cyrus and twerking. I don't know.
My boss actually at Gothamist, John Del Señor, back in 1999, he bum-rushed the stage while the Backstreet Boys were receiving their award. And he got in by taking his tuxedo that he used for his catering job and just, like, bluffing his way into the backstage area. He got back there. Him and his friend, their scheme was to promote their show called Wake Up at 3, which was, like, this really harebrained idea for a talk show at 3 in the morning. So he, like, went around to, like, Ed Lover and, like, all these celebrities backstage and got them to say, wake up at 3, like, on this, like, big camcorder. And then John got on stage, like, pushed all the Backstreet Boys aside and was like, wake up at 3, and then just walked off the stage. And then he was, like, tackled by, like, police and security.
So there has to be video of this that exists.
There is. It's on YouTube. If you Google it. He also wrote a piece for the All website on it several years ago. It's very good. I encourage all of our listeners to read it. It's very funny.
That is amazing.
It is. So that's why it was a busy week.
So it's not just, see, everyone thinks that Kanye or...
Well, the soy bomb guy was before that, wasn't he?
Well, the first one was, who was it, Ad Rock? Or who was it that came out and basically said that Spike Jonze should have won... people hitting the window here. That Spike Jonze should have won the video of the year or whatever that one year.
Oh, yeah. Well, and then when was the Rage Against the Machine guy? When the guy pointlessly climbed that giant pointy dildo spire or whatever it was.
We're giving way too much credit to the VMA now, because, like, now it's like,
well, because I don't know, I sort of grew up with it, but then, like, by grew up with it, it was like by age 13 it was not cool anymore, you know.
My last thought on the VMA is, and I've been thinking about this, and I will share this,
please share, Derek.
And I probably, we,
this is,
you
a
know,
safe space this is, for you to share.
I know, and we need to, you know, we need to start talking to Andy soon anyway, so it's like, you know, I feel like if I had hard drugs that I had bought over the internet, I might have been able to stomach watching the VMAs. But I'd find it far less offensive if they didn't, like, categorize it as music. Like, it should be, like, the Tony Awards or, like, you know, for best musical.
What?
Or best, like, well, performance by an ensemble,
okay,
or something,
so
like that.
You're saying,
but
it,
like,
should be more of, like, a cultural.
No, I think it should be more of, like, the way they give awards to musicals, because that's exactly what it is. They're not talking about the people who wrote the songs. They're not talking about the people who, like, composed the music.
Okay, here's
they're
a
talking about
why don't
the
they,
people
why don't
who
they,
are, like, acting it out on stage.
Why don't they combine the VMAs and the, like, do they still do the movie awards, MTV Movie Awards? Why don't they just combine those two?
That would
make a lot more sense.
Well,
right?
Then they wouldn't, but then, you know.
Then they wouldn't have two things to flog.
Exactly.
Okay.
Andy, did you watch the MTV VMAs?
No, I did not. I think the last one I watched, I think, was the soy bomb one, in fact.
Wow.
What is this?
The fat kid who wore the white t-shirt that said soy bomb.
I remember him, like, writing it on his bare chest, but maybe, I think you're right. I think I've just, like, embellished it in my memory.
wasn't that butt man coming in or whatever?
No, ass, or
ass man.
Ass man. That was Howard Stern.
Howard Stern.
But no, you're right. But how long ago was that? Was it 94, 95 or something?
I don't know. Yeah.
Someone's performance.
I don't know. The Rape Me one is about all I remember, so that should date me right there. Oh. Most of our listeners were like two at that point.
So Andy, who tipped you off to the Silk Road website, and when did you decide to write about it?
I got interested in this thing called Bitcoin, you know, which you guys may have heard of, this, like, decentralized cryptographic currency in 2011. And I wrote a story about it for Forbes back then when nobody really knew if it was going to take off. Bitcoins were like this weird kind of, like, anarchic currency that, you know, maybe they were going to be worth something and maybe they were, like, a total waste of money. And then in the next couple of years, Bitcoin's, like, appreciated 200-fold. Now Bitcoin is worth, like, $100. Back then, it was worth, like, half of a dollar. So if I had invested back then, I would be, like, really wealthy. But at the time, I saw that there was this website where you could spend Bitcoins to buy drugs called the Silk Road. And I didn't actually take it seriously. And then Adrian Chan at Gawker wrote a big story about Silk Road and the fact that it actually was this kind of thriving black market for drugs. And at the time, nobody knew who was running it, really. But I started spending a lot of time on the site just for investigative purposes, of course, and found that it was run by this guy who was called himself the Dread Pirate Roberts. And, you know, he was actually pretty vocal in the forums on the site. He was posting all these political manifestos and, like, love letters to his users, and seemed like a really interesting guy. So I started kind of, like, just messaging him, like, all the time, and sort of wearing away at him, asking him for an interview. And it took about 8 months, and that story just came out. So he finally granted me an interview. He was still, of course, really secretive about who he is and,
right,
you know, where he lives and his background, and, of course, anything that could help to identify him. But he told me you know, why he does what he does, and he told me some things about how the site works. yeah, it was like kind of the closest I think we're going to get to unmasking the Dread Pirate Roberts anytime soon, until he's arrested potentially.
So did you like, immediately identify yourself as a reporter?
Oh yeah,
you just yeah.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I lurked on the forums a lot and just read everybody's posts, which are all viewable if you run this software that you have to run to access right. the Silk Road. Yeah, but I announced myself to him immediately as a reporter and told him I just wanted to, you know, to help him get his message out. And he has this kind of libertarian philosophy that he's really vocal about. He's like a radical libertarian free market guy. He even has the Dread Pirate Roberts book club on the Silk Road's forums where, you know, he assigns books to the users.
So he's
read.
Trying to become like
he's
Oprah.
He's a hands-on CEO.
He's like CEO. Oprah or Julian Assange or, you know, something like that. He's like, and Karl Marx too. He's like, he wants to be seen as a kind of philosopher and not just a drug dealer.
I would like to envision the thought of Oprah Winfrey and Julian Assange having a child, and that's what he looks like.
A beautiful child.
So what was it? You said that, you know, he had what was his mission statement for running this site then, as you said, you know, you had mentioned like yeah. why he did it.
Well, he really wants to just kind of like hamstring the state, or he wants to carve out a place on the internet where the state's powers to regulate commerce and to enforce laws can't reach, and specifically for drugs. But I think he only sees that as a starting point. You know, he wants to also be able. He experimented with selling guns at one point on the site as well, and counterfeit documents. And generally, he wants to see a kind of perfect free market exist. And if it can't exist in the physical world, maybe he can build it online.
But then why do it with something that, you know, a lot of people think are detrimental to society, whether it be drugs or in the case of guns?
Yeah, well, I think that he actually sees drugs as something that aren't detrimental, that, you know, we should all have the freedom to put whatever we want in our bodies, as many libertarians believe. You know, I certainly believe that to a point, and I, you know, it's definitely a defensible argument. I don't know about selling crack and you know, making it available to kids and things. It is kind of a crazy degree that he's taken this free market philosophy to. But I think that, you know, legalizing drugs is a free market thing that everybody kind of agrees on. That's a ridiculous thing to say. But that both, like, liberal people often believe in and very right-wing libertarians.
Well, most of America believes that marijuana should be decriminalized or legalized,
yeah.
I believe.
There you go. But I don't know about heroin.
Sure.
LSD and all that.
But in terms of taking this other sort of, like, he's creating this different economy, like a different online black market, but doesn't that already exist? And also, well, in terms of existing, it already exists. Like, drug dealers exist. They've always sort of existed. So he's just sort of another drug dealer, right?
Right, that's true. I mean, he's bringing the black market online. But that's actually, it turns out that when you bring it online, it can thrive in a way that it never did in the, you know, in, like, people who would never dare to, like, try to find a cocaine dealer
sure.
in a city, or people who don't have access to
yeah.
those kinds of black markets, can order things from the Silk Road, and they're vacuum sealed and mailed to them at their house. It's like, it's totally as convenient as eBay or Amazon.
Right. And you tested this theory, right?
Right. Well, I figured that we had to make this real for readers. We had to prove not just that the Silk Road works, but we wanted to test the new, there are a couple of new competitor sites that have kind of taken the Silk Road's model and say that they can, you know, that they're offering the same thing. So we wanted to test at Forbes. We tried all three of these sites. One's called Atlantis and one is called Black Market Reloaded. And our lawyer signed off on us buying just a gram or less of marijuana from all three sites just to see how well this works. And it did, essentially. I mean,
right.
we got one of our shipments in 2 days, 2 business days. The next one came like 6 days later. The third one, we actually, on Black Market Reloaded, which is probably the least popular of these sites for drugs. You can actually buy more serious things on there, like guns and explosives. But for drugs, it seemed like it was difficult to buy anything smaller than a gram of marijuana. So we ended up having to buy from some guy in the Netherlands, and it probably got caught by customs. But it works in 2 out of 3 cases.
And what was the method of payment?
Yeah, we paid with bitcoins. A gram cost like 20... the exchange rates in like early July, a gram cost something like $23.
So explain a little bit, because I'm a little bit, I understand what the Bitcoin concept is, but it, for our listeners, you know, can you just explain it a little bit?
Not for Derek. For
well, no, no, I understand what it is conceptually, but like I've never used like how do you acquire bitcoins? Like, is it do you pay for it with like credit card or something like that, and then it just becomes this like you know, like basically a currency that you can't track?
Yeah, so you can buy bitcoins through a few exchange sites, and basically like it's not an untraceable currency, but it's a currency that isn't like regulated by any bank or any government. So the main property of Bitcoin that these privacy or anarchy focused people like is that you don't necessarily have to tie it to your identity. You don't have to, like, the way you know, when you sign up for a bank account, you have to give all this ID.
Right.
And, you know, or you have to, like, when you sign up for PayPal, you have to verify some bank account. All of that ties it to your name or your email address. It makes it really difficult to be, you know, to be anonymous. So Bitcoin, once you've, you know, maybe like the easiest way to buy Bitcoins does tie it to some email address or something, but then you can forward it on to another address. And that's just a kind of pseudonym. Nobody can necessarily figure out that address, that pseudonym, is you. Or you can send it through a kind of mix, like a laundering service that makes it really difficult to trace coins. So Bitcoins are not anonymous by default. They're not some kind of like magically untraceable currency. But if you use them really carefully, you can be pretty close to untraceable. And that's really what's made
it
possible.
And does the non-black market community use these?
Yeah, a lot of people are into Bitcoins for reasons that I sometimes really can't figure out. I mean, one of the, like, people were interested in Bitcoin in part because they were just rising in value so much. So if you bought a Bitcoin, like, in 2011, when I first wrote about it, and held onto it, you would, you know, it would be 200 times as valuable.
Right.
Or more. So that was really attractive to a lot, like the Winklevoss twins, like the Facebook guys,
right,
own like 10% of Bitcoins because they think that they're going to become billionaires. But in fact, there's only like $1 billion worth of Bitcoins out there right now. But it has started to appreciate again. So a lot of people are investing in Bitcoins, which is, I don't know if it's a good idea at all. But I think a lot of people also just see Bitcoins.
It's a bullish market. Bitcoins are a bullish market.
Yeah. If you want to like do a kind of Kramer type segment. I mean, a lot of people still believe Bitcoins are going to take over the world and replace the dollar.
I would say that there has to be, and this is, again, purely philosophical in nature, but I do have to believe that there will be some sort of internet-driven worldwide currency that will eventually kind of connect, you know, almost be the answer to a lot of the world's problems that are created by, you know, individual banking companies and institutions.
I kind of feel like it's more of a commentary on money itself, because currency is really just paper, and our currency is no longer backed by gold or silver. It's just backed by the guarantee that we're good for it, you know? So it's more like if everyone pretends that it exists, it exists. And that's sort of how currency works in general, right? So this is just the internet saying this currency exists, and it exists because we say it does.
Yeah, and because people are actually, you know, accepting it in exchange for goods. That's the other important thing. So in a way, the Silk Road is really, things like the Silk Road are really key to making Bitcoin a viable currency. But you know, I think that what a lot of Bitcoin believers think is that when there's the next like Zimbabwe or Argentina like currency collapse, maybe those people, you know, if it's available to them, they'll switch to Bitcoins instead, because that might be a more stable currency. And then whenever like the government sorts out their currency, you know, there's no reason for everybody to switch back. And at that point, everyone in Zimbabwe will be using Bitcoins instead of whatever the heck Zimbabwe currency is.
Right. Well, I feel like the Zimbabwe currency is a great way to segue into speaking to our next guest. Andy, I want you to stay here. We definitely have a lot more questions to ask you, and you can feel free to jump in at any point. But right now, we're going to speak really quickly with Sid Butler of La Savie Fave and French Kiss Records. Sid, are you there?
I'm here and fascinated by the Bitcoin conversation.
I know. I was actually going to start. Have you ever attempted to buy marijuana over the internet?
I have not. I'm a father of two kids, and actually have a very funny story about that, not having kids. But I was recently at a party where you have to roll dice, and let me start over again. I was invited to a party, and you had to bring a crappy present to the party, and within 15 minutes, you pass the dice around, and all the prizes are in the in the circle. And as the timer goes down, people start collecting the things that they want from the circle. Every time you roll doubles, you get to pull what you want. And if someone else has what you want, then you can walk over and grab it from them. So my wife and I are far from the drug trade or even having contacts or phone numbers because we're so out of it. So there was a little bit of marijuana floating around, and we're all excited, like, oh, that's what we'll get because, you know, we're out of the loop.
So that's the police calling you right now.
Exactly. It's actually my wife. Long story short is there was like 10 seconds left in the prize, and we had the little bit of, I think it was like two joints or something. We were so excited. And someone rolled double at the very last second and came over, and of all the presents that were there, came and took the weed from us. And it was a young 23-year-old girl, and we were like, really? You have access to this more than we do. We go to bed at 9:30, and we're not cool. So I was kind
of
grumpy.
What did you get instead of the two joints?
We got a tequila bottle, so that was good for us, too. But that's not illegal.
Yeah, that's not a bad present. Me and Chris were at a Christmas party with bad gifts, and I got a deck of cards. So I think you won out with.
I think I got a scratch off ticket too. So that's
yes. So yeah, we got a bottle of tequila, which was nice.
So you're killing the rock and roll dream right now. You realize that everyone's assuming that Wasabi Fob is, well, maybe not you per se, because you do you run French Kiss, but going to bed at 9:30 is killing the rock and roll dream here for our listeners.
Well, I wake up a couple hours later and party until the dawn. So. But yeah, no, I'm in my 40s now, so it's a little different.
Oh, see, he doesn't mind giving his age away. I just like to float around that I'm an older gentleman. So
right, yes,
so
I'm proud of my 40s.
So what do you know? I know personally that French Kiss has been, you know, going through a few changes. You guys now have a label group, and you guys are bringing on some other labels to distribute. But why don't you give us a little... I've always been curious about the history of Wasabi Fob and how it just kind of formed into you creating this label that's kind of been... You know, you're kind of like the driving force, not behind the band per se, but just, this kind of ringleader, if you will.
No, I'm also the driving force. Wasabi Fob started when we all went to Rhode Island School of Design, and we sort of started a band to play music and be part of the Providence scene at the time. There were some great bands back then. The one that we loved the most was one of them was called the Six Finger Satellite. Mm-hmm. And the other one was the Hydrant Terrors, and we were just obsessed with these two bands. So we went to play shows with them, and so we just sort of decided to start a band, and there was Lightning Bolt at the time as well. So there was this little community of bands that were sprouting up, and there were a lot of places to play, so we decided that we were going to start a band as well. And Seth, who plays guitar, was sort of the best musician of the band and basically taught us all what to do. And we started writing songs and drinking beer and having a good time, never thinking it would go anywhere. And then we graduated from college and moved to New York and sort of kept doing the band and having a good time. But all of a sudden, people started coming to our shows, and we started getting paid. And next thing you know, we were making more money being in Wasabi Fob and going on tour than we were with our average day jobs. So we did that for about 10 years. And pretty early on, we had put a record out, our first record with this label called Self Starter Foundation, which was based here in New York. And then slowly realized that I got really cocky and arrogant and thought I could do a better job. So I started a record label soon after we had released that first record. And I grew up in Washington, D.C. and had some roots and some ties to Discord, and called up Ian MacKay and asked him for his advice, which he gave. And I flew to Chicago and hung out with Corey Rusk from Touch and Go, and then had many conversations with Jonathan Ponerman from Sub Pop, so I felt like I was in good company.
Mm-hmm.
So we started the label, and very quickly my bandmates realized that they could give a rat's patootie, and next thing you know, it was all on me. And it wasn't very serious, and then all of a sudden, when we released the Hold Steady's record, it became very serious because they did very well very quickly.
And what was your first release under French Kiss?
The very first release was the Wasabi Fob record, The Cat and the Cobra.
Okay.
The second release was a band called The Apes. Lifter Puller, which was the band before the Hold Steady.
I think a lot of people are unaware of like your influence. I mean, a lot of these bands went on to larger things, and I think a lot of people might not realize that you guys put out a lot of these bands' early releases.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it was great because, you know, we were on tour with all these young bands, and at the time, the alternative rock band that was getting paid millions of dollars to sign these crazy labels had died.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a sort of a weird dead time in the late 90s because those deals didn't exist anymore.
Unless you were a rap rock band.
Exactly. So we quickly became friends with all these bands that were great but had no real home. So we said, hey, let's start a label. We have a label. Then they were like, cool. And next thing you know, we were putting out, you know, 1,000 records. Which at the time was a big deal, and to be honest with you, it's still a big deal.
Yeah, I was going to say, in fact, I might even argue that it's kind of more now, considering the whole, you know, digital age and everything like that. The actual physical pressing of records, it seemed, you know, even now, every label seems to be like, oh, it's limited edition, but I'm, you know, when I hear that now, I think to myself, I'm like, yeah, but, you know, were you really going to press many more than that?
Yeah, no, it's funny, when I talk to bands or even labels from the label group, they're like, oh yeah, we're going to do 1,000 this and 5,000 this. I'm like, what year are you living in? I think the success of French Kiss has been, if we can sell 1,000 or 3,000, we've done very well.
Right.
So when we budget for our band, that's what we budget for. We've had a lot of success with that model, and we've had bands that have done very well, the Dodos and Local Natives and Passion Pit and, you know, Let's Have a Fob, Antlers. So we've had a good run. But yeah, we're very modest, and I think that's because we started at a time when modesty was in fashion.
Well, I also think there's a lot of people who are under the, you know, under the idea that you start a label and you have a band take off, or you have a band that becomes a hit. But it's, you know, I always give the analogy of like playing the lotto. You know, it's like you can try to play the lotto while you're doing it, or you can create like a very solid catalog that will exist forever, that will always be able to, you know, obviously on one side make you money, but then also when you are trying to get other bands or trying to, you know, get other deals or whatever, you have this foundation behind it.
That's correct. You have assets, you have rights, and you have, you know, a history. We don't really care about making a 7-inch that glows in the dark. We care about a band having a career.
Right. You know? So and now you've moved on to the label group.
Yeah, we actually have French Kiss TV with David Cross through the world of YouTube, and we have the label group. These two wonderful women helped me run it. This woman Dina and this woman Emily, and they were just out in LA killing it. And I think they've signed 5 labels in the last month. So
excellent!
They're on fire.
Do you feel like should you be dropping any names right now, or is it still too early to say?
No, it's still too early to say.
All right.
Well, we have a lot to learn.
Yeah. and then. This is one of the other things I wanted to ask you, although now I'm taking it backwards in time. Let's just say, hypothetically, I had all 4 of the Let's Have a Fob 7-inches that you guys put out on 4 different labels.
Right.
What do you think that could go for if I was to try to sell that on eBay?
Well, I would say that you need the rest of the 7-inches first.
How many are there?
There's 9.
Oh, God. I thought there was only 4.
No, there's 9 for the set. And the set themselves would probably go for a good chunk.
Yeah, I figured if I had all 9, man, I got to go back.
Yeah, there's 9 7-inches, and some are really hard to find because they actually did actually make a limited edition.
And what were the labels that put them out? Do you remember?
Yes.
I mean, I remember some of the big ones. I know... well, why don't you run through them so I don't have to...
Well, Sub Pop was the first one, and there was a label in Germany called Xmas that did one. Chunklet, which is a guy named Henry Owings who does Chunklet magazine in Atlanta.
I see he still tweets. Is he still active, do you know?
He's still alive, so I assume he's still active, but I'm sure he's active in some way. I think Chunklet is his baby that he will take with him wherever he goes.
Right, right.
And I hope that he continues to do it, because Henry is a sarcastic son of a bitch that the world desperately needs.
I know. I was going to say, the music critic world definitely needs a voice like his more often, I would say. They exist, but we need someone more often like that.
Yes, Pitchfork can't rule the negative review. I think Henry, if he cared, he would be on fire.
Right, right.
But yeah, he put out a 7-inch. He actually put out the vinyl of... Let's Stay Friends as well. We have a long history with Henry. Then there was another one. Oh my God, I'm totally spacing on all this right now. I'm totally embarrassed.
Didn't Suicide Squeeze do one?
Oh, yeah, Suicide Squeeze. Thank you. Suicide Squeeze. Yes.
I think I have the American ones. That's why I do have the Chunklet Suicide Squeeze and Sub Pop one for sure.
Oh, yeah, DeSoto did our second one. DeSoto was a label from D.C., and they put out one. Oh, my God, I could go dig them up. They're in a box.
See, I have all the ones that you remember, so that makes me feel a little bit better about it.
Yes, let me see if I can find them. Grace, do you know how
I don't want you to have to feel too obligated. I'm sure we could also Google that. I was just very intrigued by that notion.
Derek, yeah, no, you basically ruined Derek's.
In a while. They're hard to find.
Derek had a retirement plan all set up, and you basically ruined his 401k, because that's it.
Exactly.
Those 4-7 inches.
Well, yeah, when you're working in the music industry, that's what you hope is your 401k.
Yes, they're signed David Cross, 7 inches are my 401k.
So while we're still here with Andy really quick, do you see the next step in French Kiss Records and or label group moving over to Bitcoins?
Well, I was thinking that your retirement plan absolutely should. I mean, if you just sold those four records, you know, invest in a Bitcoin now, then you could...
I probably should, actually. I definitely should buy some shares of Bitcoin or look into it. I'm kind of obsessed with the book, actually, that Tim from the Subway Fob suggested I read called Who Owns the Future? It's by a guy named Jaron Lanier, he invented the term virtual reality. But I just started this book, but basically it's about, you know, what will money be like, who will own sort of the economy of the future. And there'll be no middle class at all because, you know, people that have middle class jobs or trade jobs will be gone. So the lower class will be completely content because they'll have all these Facebook and Instagram, all these things. But, you know, they'll be totally relaxed. But the rich will be so rich it'll be crazy.
We'll be dead by then, right? Hopefully.
I hope. Yeah, maybe we will be.
Yeah, that's like,
okay, cool. I'm just making sure.
But yeah, it's interesting with 3D printing. You know, you can go to Amazon and say, "Hey, give me my shoes," and a 3D printer will make your shoes for you. So, someone that actually has to make your shoes will no longer have a job.
But they're not actually going to make your music for you, right? Like, that's at least they'll be like creative class, right?
Yes, the creative class will be poor, which they are now, and always looking for an investor. But we'll see what happens. Maybe Bitcoin is the way to go.
So, I guess we, you know, I want to wrap up with you so we can. Get back to Bitcoins, I guess. But I do want to ask you a few things. No, you guys are playing tomorrow.
That's correct.
And how often? I know it's kind of, you guys now wait for, I guess, a special occasion, if you will, to play, especially in the New York area. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, we actually haven't played. We had a show last weekend in Los Angeles and played the FYFS, but right. It's been about 2 years since our last show. But yeah, we kind of only like to play special occasions now. We have to get excited about it. All those years of playing Cincinnati and, you know, Little Rock, Arkansas are long gone.
Somewhere one of our listeners just hung up and just closed the internet.
Yes, or they bought a plane ticket to New York or to England in November when we play again.
And that's for ATP?
Yes, and we're playing with television, and when I say that out loud, I can't even believe it.
Yeah, that's amazing. Is that the U.S. one or the U.K. one?
It's the U.K. one, and they're playing Marky Moon, so it's kind of a big deal. We're like, what? Are you kidding me?
Yeah, that's going to be amazing. And before I let you go, is there anything, we're not trying to plug everything, but I am kind of curious what you guys have on the horizon outside of... I mean, I'm really intrigued by the label group and kind of what you guys have coming out on that. But, you know, what else do you guys have that's coming out in the near future?
Well, French Kiss Records has two bands that I think actually will help me with my retirement. One is called Drowners. They're from here in New York. And they're fantastic. They're sort of I really don't want to put words in their mouth or in yours. But check them out. The record will come out in January. And then this band from Cincinnati, Ohio called Tweens. Who are on tour with the Breeders right now. Their record comes out in February.
Who hopefully is not listening to the segment when you said you didn't like to play Cincinnati.
Exactly. Well, you know, maybe that's the Subway Fob, of course. I love to play Cincinnati.
Are they big fans of eating chili on top of spaghetti?
I think they're big fans of a lot of things that I'm not aware of.
maybe they're fans of I was going to say
Derek's age again.
The Silk Road. That's what I was trying to get to. I see how it's all about symmetry here. I'm trying to close the gaps. You know, bring it all home.
Yeah, I wish I could.
Well, Sid, thank you very much for taking the time. You guys are always welcome anytime. Obviously, we're fans of everything you do. So, yeah, thank you.
Well, I appreciate the love, and thanks for thinking of us.
Yeah.
Okay, guys, see you soon.
Cool. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye.
So, yeah, I think we might have turned Sid on to Bitcoins.
I think so.
All I know is I'm running home and I'm going to invest in some Bitcoins after
this. I'm bummed because Tim wasn't on the show, because the last time I saw the Savvy 5 play was in Texas 3 years ago, and he was swinging a strobe light around and it smacked me in the face. And it's kind of a miracle my jaw wasn't broken or my eye didn't come out of my skull.
For all our listeners out there, we did attempt to get Tim on the show to give a public apology.
Not that
apology.
Sid wasn't great. Sid was
amazing. No. I'm
just saying,
to give a public apology to Chris.
But I feel like it should have been like a public apology to everyone he's injured. But
I was
going
to say
time,
that's probably happened to more.
Yeah,
more people.
I'm definitely not the only one.
That's a good question for him though. Like, you know, I wonder if there's been any legal ramifications. Most people sign a waiver, but isn't that common? You go to a show, you
sort of walk in like, hey, you might be injured at this thing. Sorry about that. Enjoy your vitamin water.
So before the show is over, we got a few minutes left. I wanted to get back to Andy because this conversation is it intrigues me a lot, because I think it has a lot to do with
Derek's nipples are rock hard right
aside
now,
from
for those of you can't see them.
You know, we can just I won't throw out the notion of buying drugs on the internet, but that kind of notion is kind of a sidebar almost to the real theory or you know, thought about this.
Let's just be honest. I mean, it is the most exciting thing you can do with Bitcoins right now. I mean, it's going to put like every New York drug dealer out of business eventually.
Well, it's kind of when you were talking about like he's just doing it because or you know, the Dread Pirate Roberts is doing it because it's kind of what will get him attention. I mean, he could have, in theory, been like, I'm going to be a bookseller.
Right. I mean, there are people who sell everything. Like, there was a guy who started selling alpaca socks on the internet for Bitcoins, like, in early 2011, and he probably is a millionaire now. I mean, he must have made a huge amount of money just because of the appreciation of Bitcoins. But I don't know why anybody wanted to spend Bitcoins in alpaca socks. That's, like, the thing that doesn't, you know, nobody needs any kind of like privacy or anonymity around their alpaca socks.
Maybe there's stuff in the alpaca socks with heroin or something like that.
Well, that's possible, yeah. Is that your strategy?
Like, no, but I am kind of curious. What is. Okay, so.
So, like, the term drug mule will be like drug alpaca now?
Yeah. So how does one accept Bitcoin? I'm sorry that we've gotten on totally a bit like Bitcoin.
Bitcoin is like this black hole of conversation you can just go into forever.
I do want to get to your book is This Machine Kills Secrets, and that is so topical it almost hurts. Why don't you explain it, because I don't want to give it. I'm bad at giving things justice.
Yeah, well, in 2010, I interviewed Julian Assange, and I did a big story on WikiLeaks for Forbes, and then the book that I expanded into a book, it became like a book about the history and future of leaking information anonymously. And really, what changed the act of leaking information from the 20th century to the 21st is that we have all these anonymity tools now. So WikiLeaks really, its sort of secret ingredient was Tor, just like Silk Road. WikiLeaks ran its submission system that allowed anybody to leak information on a Tor hidden service, so that if you visited it and you leaked information, you were anonymous too. And Bradley Manning, who now, you know, has like been convicted and sentenced for leaking huge amounts of national secrets to WikiLeaks, he was running Tor when he leaked all that stuff. So, in fact, we can look back and see that he wouldn't have gotten caught also if he hadn't just outed himself. He told like a this hacker that he had been doing this, and that's how he got caught. But there's no evidence that he technically would have been caught by like the NSA surveillance or anything.
Right.
So it seems like Tor is a powerful tool, not just for buying drugs or child pornography. It is used for all those things, and it's used by political dissidents in other countries to like avoid the secret police and everything. But it's also a powerful tool for whistleblowers, and that's what Julian Assange saw, and Tor was really what made WikiLeaks possible. So that was kind of like the prequel to this story about how Tor has made like a an actual physical black market possible. WikiLeaks was almost kind of like an anonymous black market for information. You know, now it's gone into like actual e-commerce.
You know what the problem is? They just need a better publicist.
WikiLeaks?
No, Tor.
Yeah, I don't know. I
mean, because everything you're it's just because everything you're mentioning is like stuff that inherently I think people are you know adverse to,
except for maybe the child pornography.
yeah, but everybody loves that.
Right. But okay, so you talked about Bradley Manning, and he was just sentenced. He obviously, I mean, the hacker was the one who added him. But how much? And you know, the Obama administration is going on this unprecedented sort of legal,
right, like a war on whistleblowers.
Sure.
Yeah.
And you know, you talk to a lot of sources for your book. How much of a chilling effect does this stuff have? Does the Obama administration's push against whistleblowers have? And I mean, does it really have an appreciable effect? Because we're talking about Bitcoins, we're talking about Tor. We're not talking about how people are scared to buy drugs online with Bitcoins. We're talking about how it's, you know, starting to thrive. Like, how much
right.
of this sort of gray area anonymity is really of concern to people who are trying to bring, like, state secrets to light? Or
I think that a lot of people looked at Bradley Manning, and they still look at him, and they say, oh, well, this must be, you know, this is kind of like an intimidation tactic. He's just been sentenced to 35 years in prison, like the longest prison sentence ever for a leak to the press. So that's going to prevent people from leaking any information. But it doesn't seem to me like that's the case, partly because there's no sign that the technical tools that Bradley Manning used are vulnerable, that they can be surveilled, or, you know, he seemed to be protected. And you can see with Edward Snowden, which actually was maybe, you know, an even more important leak, he wasn't identified before he escaped the country. He doesn't seem to have trusted those tools to protect his identity, but he did successfully use encryption tools to leak this stuff to Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras without getting caught. So just in some ways, it seems like leaking is more powerful than ever. And Edward Snowden, you know, is the next Bradley Manning, and kind of what he's exposed has had like a much bigger impact than probably what Manning did.
Right. And can you explain why you think that is? Because some people will argue that, you know, Bradley Manning exposed, you know, the killing of Iraqi civilians, right? And he also exposed a lot of diplomatic cables, which really shed light on how the United States wields power throughout the world. People argue, people like Jeffrey Toobin or some of these other people who are like, you know, Snowden, he's just a grandstanding person who revealed all the stuff that we already really knew about and that technically is not illegal. So why do you feel that his revelations are more important than Bradley Manning?
Well, Bradley Manning never got a congressional hearing to discuss what he leaked. You know, I mean, he did help to cause a revolution in Tunisia, and in my book, I also follow the trail to Bulgaria, where what he leaked also helped to spark a kind of Bulgarian revolution, where the president was kicked out of power. But nothing really substantive happened in the U.S. except a lot of discussion, maybe like a shortening of the Iraq War, but that's debatable. But with Edward Snowden, we've seen that, you know, people in Congress have pointed to these documents and they've called for more transparency from the NSA. Like, you know, we want to know what's happening in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court that's supposed to be overseeing the NSA, but doesn't really in any way that we can check on. So, you know, there are actual bills in Congress that are meant to make that process of like overseeing the NSA more transparent and, you know, disinfected with sunlight.
Right. And then, you know, folks like James Clapper, who's the Obama administration's security czar or information czar, I guess you'd say. He lied under oath. I mean, perjured himself.
It seems like it, yeah.
It seems like it. So, I mean, yeah. I don't know. I think I tend to agree with you.
It seems like Snowden is like, I mean, I think he was probably inspired by Bradley Manning. And he did in some ways what Bradley Manning never managed to do, which is actually change U.S. policy.
What else? I mean, this is a really kind of wildly speculative question, but what do you imagine is, I mean, it seems Snowden's leaks cut pretty deep into the security apparatus in the United States. I mean, how much deeper can we really go? I mean, what's the next sort of leap?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we learned from Snowden was the inner workings of the NSA, which is, you know, to some extent, which is pretty crazy, because the NSA is the most secretive agency in America, and we don't even know how big it is. It might have the biggest budget of any federal agency. But there's a few other agencies, you know, to go. I mean, the NYPD, the LAPD, the DEA, the FBI, all of them could have their own Edward Snowdens, not to mention, like, the whole private sector. You know, and, in fact, I think that probably Bank of America or whatever, you know, these megalithic like corporations might be even more vulnerable to leakers. So, you know, with my book, I was trying to sort of trace the who was going to be the next WikiLeaks, because all these tools are still out there. You can run your own Tor-based anonymous submission system and become, you know, your own little WikiLeaks if you want to. And I really thought that that was going to happen. And in fact, it hasn't. I think in part because, you know, like Derek said, maybe Tor needs a better like
well,
publicist.
Well, like the New Yorker just started one like a month or two ago.
So,
but I feel like people are just going to submit their really shitty cartoon captions.
The captions, yeah.
I mean, I don't know what they have to really. But I mean, So the financial industry.
Well, no, that's an interesting point you mentioned about the New Yorker, though. So is this could, I mean, it could kind of, let me try to figure out how to say this, but it could kind of like be an answer to the both things you're talking about, because it could kind of be the way you get around having to be prosecuted or even just like looked at harshly for leaking information to the press, which is something else that kind of came up with the Snowden thing. Versus
you mean that the press itself being attacked as a conspirator,
right.
as the guardian.
And this way it's kind of like that safe way, you know. So it's not like basically keeping people out of harm.
We don't know where we got this.
Exactly. Yeah, it's like laundering information, the same way that Bitcoin can be used to launder money.
Sure.
Basically,
right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Before we go, I need you to answer this question: how does one accept Bitcoins? How do you get to that point as a business?
It's pretty easy. You just like Google Bitcoin and you'll find some wallet software, basically like these applications. The one probably, I think that maybe the one that people should use is called Multibit. This is not like an advertisement. It's
No.
But, and then you just set it up and you'll have a Bitcoin address, and then you just say potentially on a radio show, this is my Bitcoin address, send me lots of free Bitcoins and, you know, you can retire.
I'm just curious if now would it be, would it be lucrative of me to say, sell records or something like that and collect Bitcoins instead of cash?
Well, that, if you believe that, you know, Ben Bernanke cannot be trusted and that the dollar is, you know, going to crash and we're going to live in this, like...
But can't they live symbiotically? Can't they live side by side?
I would be more concerned with the United States government making Bitcoins themselves illegal.
Illegal.
Like, isn't that a possibility?
It is, and that it's unclear what that would do to Bitcoin, you know.
Is that likely or plausible to happen?
It seems like the United States government is starting to regulate Bitcoin and to try to make it harder to like do nasty illegal things with
right.
it. I don't know if they can succeed, though.
I wonder if they even have jurisdiction, because, I mean, who's to say what country that it's you
it's
know.
Not like they're looking at all of our emails all the time or anything. It's not like they would know.
No, I'm just saying, like, how, you know, it's like it's a worldwide currency or something like that. Who's going to have jurisdiction over that? You know, it's going to have to be an international type of...
The whole idea of Bitcoin is that the government can't touch it. You know, they can't, like, just start printing more of them like they do with dollars. And they can't shut it down either. It's, you know...
Yeah,
is
there a finite amount of Bitcoins?
There will... I think in something... I forget the date. Like, 2040.
Uh-huh.
All the Bitcoins that will ever be out there will be out there. But they can still keep appreciating. And you know, today, a Bitcoin is worth $100. By then, you know, in Bitcoin believers' minds, it's going to be worth like $1 trillion or whatever, and you can slice it really finely, and we'll be spending, you know, like a micro or nano Bitcoin on our bag of weed instead of like half of a Bitcoin.
So now, do you only use Bitcoins for other Bitcoins, or can you then cash them in?
You can cash them out. Yeah, you can trade them in for regular currency, but that is becoming more difficult to do without identifying yourself. I mean, you have to somehow get them, you know, laundered and then back to some exchange where you can get dollars instead.
But that's right, but that's sort of the hilarious thing is, like, if the believers, it's like, oh, Bitcoin's the future, I'm going to cash these out for normal currency in 15 years. That still assumes that there's going to be another sort of currency, which, again, sort of flies in the face of the whole reason to support Bitcoin. So it's like...
Well, you don't have to cash them out for dollars to make them valuable.
That's true. But you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It's like this whole idea of them scheming to have some sort of investment.
Well, my point is more twofold. It's like I was asking, can't they live side by side as like, you know, like there's multiple currencies in the world right now? And secondly, wouldn't that open up the notion of using Bitcoins for things that are not illegal. Well, like the alpaca socks. Like, is that guy, what is he? I mean, I'm assuming he's cashing them in. I mean, he can't be a millionaire on virtual coins, can he?
Yeah, we can always cash bitcoins in for drugs instead and just create like a huge warehouse of heroin.
But that's what I'm saying.
Like Goldman Sachs and cash them into aluminum and then move them from warehouse to warehouse artificially inflate. Yeah. I mean, couldn't you do that with bitcoins? Couldn't the Winklevoss twins do that and just take their store of bitcoins and then move them around in some way to where they appreciate more?
I have no idea. I think people who believe that bitcoins believe that they're just going to naturally do that. Because the thing about, the dollar depreciates because I guess it's like an inherently inflationary currency. You can print more of them, but bitcoins are inherently deflationary, people believe, because you can't print any more of them. Eventually, we're going to run out. Just like mining some, scarce resource, there's not going to be that much of it left. So it has to get more valuable over time. So that's one reason Bitcoin believers think that Bitcoins are going to get more valuable.
What about the counterfeit Bitcoin business? How
that's nobody's figured that out yet. That's the thing. Like, Bitcoins are cryptographically not counterfeitable. You can steal them. You can break into somebody's computer and just take them. But or just whatever, grab their laptop
and take their.
But nobody's cracked it. Like, as far as we know, not even the NSA has figured out how to defraud or counterfeit a Bitcoin.
I knew a guy when I lived in DC who worked for the NSA. One of the nicest people I've ever met. But he spoke Mandarin, and he drove to Maryland to work every day. And the only thing he told us, we're all pestering about his job all the time. And he was like, oh, no, shut up. And he ended up telling us one day that he just listens to phone calls all day long in Mandarin, and he transcribes everything that's said. And we're like, well, whose phone calls? Like, where are they coming from? He's like, that's it.
So he was definitely not supposed to tell you that, I'm pretty sure.
I'm sure he's not. But I'm not going to say his name, John Smith.
That sounds like a horrible job.
Yeah, he was never happy. I mean, he's a really...
I mean, I do an interview, and I'm not trying to say, like... But I give it to an intern and be like, here, transcribe this.
Right. No, he was not happy. And it's, DC, too, so he, had to fight an hour of traffic out there and then an hour back every day. And literally... his job was to just infringe the rights of others all day.
But they're Chinese people. Come on.
Yeah, they don't. Yeah, yeah.
But I do have to say that one thing the NSA is probably not going to leak is the suicide rate of NSA employees.
Right. Yeah. I don't know.
That seems
we got to wait for the next Edward.
Exactly. But now it's all this is coming to light. I'm like, Jesus. Like, now I understand his pain.
Yes. Well, Andy, thank you very much. I want to say that this has been probably my favorite show. No offense to any of our other guests that we've had here, but this is both topical and super interesting. I could go on, like you said.
Well, I've never had the opportunity before to talk about Bitcoin in the company of someone from the Savvy Fab, so special.
I feel kind of guilty that we've kind of took so much time talking about Bitcoins, but it totally intrigues me. You might see Derek Evers.
If any of the other guests want to egg Derek's house, I'm happy to help them do that, because you just insulted a lot of people.
Wait, what are you talking about?
Well, saying this is the best show and everything.
I thought you were talking about
that. Don't say that on the air.
So we'll leave with this one thing on the air. If you were to suggest a drug buying website on the internet of the ones used,
the most reliable.
Yes.
You got to go with just brand A, which is Silk Road.
Silk Road.
And the Dread Pirate Roberts wouldn't let me say anything else.
We're going to
kill him?
No, we're going to have to extend this conversation because we kind of started as that as the starting point, and we never, this whole person that exists that we didn't, you spent 8 months with, we didn't even really talk about.
Yeah, another time.
Next time.
Another time.
That's true. And we thought we would do it because it's Labor Day and, people would want recreational things for Labor Day.
That was a tie-in? I don't remember that.
It was a very loose tie-in.
The labor unions are all wrapped up in Bitcoins or something?
No, I was thinking about it. You get the day off.
Oh, okay.
You got to order fast, though.
Yeah. Two-day shipping.
Yeah.
Anyway, guys.
Thanks, Sid.
Thank you, Sid. Thank you, Andy. Thanks to all of our listeners, and I hope you have a wonderful Labor Day.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.